Thank you for listening to a reading presented by the Poetry Center of Chicago. The Poetry Center is an independent, nonprofit arts organization promoting poetry in Chicago through readings, workshops, and arts education. To learn more about the Poetry Center, to read poems by our students in Chicago Public Schools, or to donate, please visit www.poetrycenter.org.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for coming to the Chicago Historical Society. This is the only second time we've had an event here, and it gives me great pleasure to see you all here and to do a couple of things, to celebrate poetry and to celebrate the poetry of Andrei Codrescu. My name is Kenneth Clark, and I am the Executive Director of the Poetry Center of Chicago. And on behalf of the Board of Directors and myself and the staff and all the volunteers you saw welcoming you this evening, welcome. Founded in 1973, by Paul Carroll and a team of influential Chicago poets, some of whom are here this evening, the Poetry Center has presented through its annual reading series hundreds of the world's best poets. And they've done so for the people of Chicago. It's a general, open, for the public reading series. This is our 29th year, 29 years of uninterrupted poetry programming, and that's no small feat for a small not-for-profit. The Poetry Center's board and I are thrilled to offer you this evening's event, as well as several other poetry readings over the next few months if you didn't pick up a brochure at the door, which I dare you to get through all those volunteers without getting one. Please pick one up. Inside the brochure, you'll find information about our reading series for the fall and also about hands-on stanzas. It's a program that basically pays poets to be in residence at Chicago Public Schools to teach children how to read and write poetry. I call it a rogue literacy program because they're learning vocabulary and all sorts of things through the learning of reading and writing and poetry. This year, the sixth year, will feature 2,000 students. None of this is easy to accomplish, but the Poetry Center has many, many friends, especially its members and its volunteers, and for all the new members here this evening and for the volunteers that helped this evening, can we hear a round of applause for those people that helped make this possible? It's also possible from our many sponsors and funders. We are proud to be sponsored by and in residence at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, where we've had our home since 1996. Major programming support comes from Poetry Center members, the Lannan Foundation, the Lloyd A. Fry Foundation, the Polk Brothers Foundation, the Fred and Susan Novy Family Foundation, the Illinois Arts Council, a state agency, the Elizabeth F. Cheney Foundation, and the Chicago Community Trust Young Leaders Fund. Special thanks to Cable Access Network, who are these guys in the audience, who will be broadcasting this on CAN TV 21 later in the year. A couple things, here's the commercial part. We are selling limited edition prints, also called broadsides, of Andrei Codrescu's poem called The American Dream. Members do receive a 20% discount on those. It's basically poetry that lives on your walls as opposed to in your bookcase. Also, make sure to pick up your indestructible and versatile Poetry Center L.L. Bean book and tote bag. They're out there. You can look at them and cart all your Andrei books home with you. And the books are being sold, and we are being in-kind sponsored by Barbara's Bookstore. It is Chicago's independent bookstore, independent like the Poetry Center. We're thrilled to have them here tonight. Tonight's event will consist of live poetry. We will have a question and answer conducted by the artist himself. And last but not least, a party right here at the Big Shoulders Cafe. It's just down the hall and around the corner where we can have some drinks with Andre. It's my pleasure now to introduce John Ruzick, president of the board of the Poetry Center, and he's largely responsible for a lot of the high drinks and trouble the Poetry Center has been causing lately, and he's going to introduce the artist. John?
Thank you, Ken. Welcome, and thank you for coming. Andrei Codrescu is one of the most prolific hyphenates writing today. He has published 20 volumes of poetry, including translations of Max Jacob and Lucien Blaga, 4 volumes of fiction, several collections of his NPR commentaries, and 4 volumes of memoirs. He is professor of English at Louisiana State University and edits the very entertaining literary magazine Exquisite Corpse. In the foreword to Codrescu's astonishing poetic debut, license to carry a gun. Paul Carroll wrote, "Every poet at one time or another must wish for some magical power to transform himself and perhaps transform the world by revealing the secrets of the trees, animals, rocks, stars and sun, others, and the countenance of the immortals." That the poet could think of himself as a witch doctor or a fallen angel among Chicagoans, one whose speech becomes incantation to summon the divinities. I would haunt the open shelves on the third floor of the Chicago Public Library, searching for that unknown magical book, which would be all that I wanted poems to be. I never found that book, but when I first read License to Carry a Gun in manuscript, I felt that, finally, I held it in my hands. Codrescu has further earned that high praise and steadily built upon it. Codrescu believes, "The poetic activity consists in overthrowing poetry for its own sake. The poetic, I tell my students, is the enemy of poetry. Every poem is a complete critique of all the poetry before it, whether the poet knows it or not. The fun begins when the poet knows it." Codrescu's poems are challenging, happily so, necessarily so. "Language is a battlefield," he said. "It is littered with the corpses of words killed by ideologies, strangled to death by advertising, assassinated by political opportunists, drowned in the urine of bureaucratic sadists." On this field, poets have the very big job of rendering the killers of words inefficient through paradox, irony, erudition, and sound. At the same time, they must save the still living words from the intensifying hunt for them by the purveyors of content. Amen. It gives me great pleasure to welcome one of America's most accomplished and supple writers, Andrei Codrescu.
What a wonderful introduction. I could just lie back and listen to things like that. However, one has to go on. And it is true that Paul Carroll, amazingly enough, picked this manuscript that I sent him in, about 1969. The book came out in 1970. And I sent him these poems, and he liked them. And wrote to me. The only problem with it is that the book that I had sent him was written by three different people, all of whom I had made up. There was Julio Hernandez, who was a Puerto Rican poet in jail in New York. There was Peter Boone, who was a young fascist, just back from Vietnam, with all kinds of visions of fire and doom in his head. And there was Alice Henderson Codrescu, who was a sort of a proto-lesbian feminist radical of an age that was just coming on, actually. It wasn't quite there yet. So I sent Paul all these three books, you know, and I said, well, you know, we make three books. And then he called, you know, we discussed this. He said, well, you know, we really can't afford to publish three different books and present all these people the way you want them to, i.e. complete personalities with their biography in different books. So how about if we put them all under one cover or selection from their poems and then call it, you know, something by Andrei Codrescu, which, you know, happened to be the name I had just picked recently. And so we discussed this, and I thought, yeah, well, okay, you know. I mean, mainly I decided, yeah, well, let's do this book with three different characters in it, and there will be sections by each one of these poets in the book, mainly because I was just, you know, wanted all my friends to die of envy. Because I was living in New York at the time, and I hadn't been in this country very long, and they're all my good friends, the New York poets, and they were good poets, and they're terrific poets, and, you know, they all sent their manuscripts to Paul for the Big Table Award, and I got it. And it caused them no small amount of suffering, actually, you know, which is always, you know, extremely satisfying to see your friends suffer, not, you know, I mean, in a friendly way. Ted Bergen, who was one of my teachers and mentors and a wonderful poet, used to say, you know, I love to travel to strange places to watch the natives suffer, you know, and I mean, that's really why one travels, you know, I mean. You don't really travel to see the sights. You travel to see why people feel bad in paradise. You know, what is it? You know, I mean, you live in, you know, La Jolla, and you feel terrible. What's wrong with you? So anyway, what I thought I would do is read a few poems from this first collection of poems that Paul Carroll of Chicago and Big Table Press published then and by these different people, and then read riskily some of my new poems, because I say it's a risk because I just have been typing these poems and not reading them, so you'll be privy to my embarrassment in first reading them. So here are some poems from my first book, which I wrote when I was 21 years old, fresh to America, speaking no English whatsoever except these words that you hear. Because I didn't know any more words than could fit on a girl's arm, basically, you know. And this is from Julio Hernandez, who, the, you know, Puerto Rican poet in jail, who had the nerve to say things like this. There is an orange rotting on the table, closer to freedom than I ever was. I will throw it away soon. Its smell gives me the same sweet hallucinations I had when I was holding a gun. Orange of sun, my useless state of mind. Julio, by the way, was quite passive in an odd way, you know, because he would do things like write an epitaph, which is something I recommend to everyone, whether you're a poet or not. You should get up every morning and write your epitaph. You know, just in case you die and there's nothing to write on there. It's a good exercise. Epitaph. Julio Hernandez does not lie here. He lies in your grave. And then there was, you know, my feminist young woman. I want to touch something sensational like the mind of a shark, the white electric bulbs of hunger moving straight to the teeth. And let there be rain that day over New York. There is no other way I can break away from bad news and cheap merchandise. The woman with a Macy's shopping bag just killed me from across the street. It is comfortable to want peace from the mind of a shark. The storm outside must be the kind you read about in the newspapers, killer of babies and bums, the kind of rain that goes on in the subway when I hold on to the coat of a fat man whose disastrous life makes me happy. And there's a poem called Dream Dogs, which again was written about 1967 or so. Years ago, it was easy to dream of wolves and wake up your lover to show him the blood on your hip. The wolves had ties and followed after every sentence, rather polite. Now there are police dogs using tear gas, and the lover next to you doesn't wake up. And a poem expressing my terrible distress as having to work, albeit briefly, in New York. At night, the day is constantly woken up by exploding dream objects until all our days are tired and collapse on our hearts like loud zippers breaking in the middle. I sleep in the daytime with my head on the piano. I sleep at night, too, standing on the roof. I sleep all the sleep that is given me, plus the sleep of those who can't sleep and the sleep of great animals who lie wounded and unable to sleep. I'm dead tired from the work everyone does ceaselessly around me, from the work the morning crowds are going to do after they are thrown up by the 1,000 miles of toast and cologne into the buses and subways, from the work the plants do to get water, from the labors of beasts looking for meat, from the labors of speaking, replying, writing, from the work going on inside me with a million greedy cells beating the shit out of each other, from the work of the sun turning around and the earth turning around it. I'm tired in general and sleepy in particular. I have a great desire to move elsewhere. This is a poem clearly written some time ago, and sort of a little love note to New York. The streets of this strange metropolis, frozen spaghetti, fear of ghosts. The scarred pavements have a very eloquent texture of bums woven with empty bottles and soot, an ancient tapestry. On this curious mattress, on bounces looking for sex. Layers and layers of sex for each layer of you. Tongue overlaps with 10,000 other tongues. Genitals are enmeshed in so many other genitals that a ball of flame floats permanently around the city. If you think this is rough, you don't know the heart of it because it's silky and funny and feels like the breeze of hereafter. Of course, one writes this poems. And then again, poem written again in the city called The Threat. I am not looking for your jugular, only for your eyes. That isn't exactly accurate. I want both. And if you ask, as you should, if you like yourself, why do I go for such ferocious treats? I must admit that there is something unexploded in my gut, and it wants you because there is an unexploded something in yours too. A music box we swallowed on your children, the growing up, which is learning to handle terror. Was there something in the food, or is the government responsible for it? It's nothing I can stick my knife into and say, for sure, it's this. And yet, I want it out more than I want these words. I was never a very big fan of words, you know, being a, for all that being a poet, you know, I thought words are such palliatives, you know, I mean, you know, but they're okay. I mean, they work. In 1980, I was in New York City for teaching, well, being a guest, really, of my good friend George Therese Dickinson, a wonderful poet and a lovely woman who was editor of a magazine called Assassin, and she was teaching at the Bellevue Ward for the Criminally Insane at Bellevue. And I was her guest on this particular night, and we went in there and did, you know, what one does there, which she knew better how to do. I mean, I was, you know. But, and then we left, and it was an historic night as it happened. And this poem is about that, but it's also not just about that. It's a poem of praise to life, New York City as well. Music. There were no bums in my pores. New York had opened my pores and bedenimed and bent over, walked in my fantasies, shoving bums. The stores were open and the hours late. Expectations were being fed, not sent to work like in faraway San Francisco. I could speed up, slow down, grimace and guffaw, move my hands and look up to the lit windows, filled with admiration for the natives, though not wanting to be asked in since my living room at the moment was the biggest. I was digging the streets and the streets dug me. Every lunatic sped toward its co-lunatic. Bellevue was lit up like another apartment building, and in fact a party of sorts was going on, with the inmates happy to be warm even if as they were being hurt. Ambulances piled in front and people went in and a few came out, and the enormous hallways could have fit a communist city's living rooms, which they did, because on several floors the inmates slept there. But these hallways were dirty green and bright yellow, and the neon was dirty, and the unhappy floors were track marked by wheelchairs and police boots and mad jigs and flares and broken glass. The floor, to be sure, was a picture of hell. The prison ward was behind two tall gates and wire mesh windows, an easy jailbreak. And the cops were half cops and half social workers, and in go the two poet workers with their two culture cops, i.e. books. And there are the prisoners, half wanting to look at a woman and half desirous to look at free folk and half sick of each other and half sick and half serious criminals wanting to improve their lot in life and half mad criminals who had it in for the other half. One came with a bed and a trapeze for his bandaged arm and half a body in a cast. And another walked in wheeling a tall steel cane on a flying saucer from which flew an IV bag connected to his arm. And as he walked, he recited bathroom walls, but was interrupted in mid-rhyme by an atmosphere of human color, occasioned mostly by a reader of bestsellers who wanted to write them because he had lived dramatically and was interested in technique. And his interest led to metaphysical questions, which gave the poets license to interrupt. Another was grim and tall and black. And in his head, he carried the entire philosophy of an obscure mystical sect in severe couplets. In the middle of the pyramid, there is an eye. The dollar bill has a lookout in the fourth sky. The steps to the Capitol are 73. That is the number to cross the zebra and the flea. I am probably being unjust to a grim mystical doctrine, which the man whispered before being led out by Big Sister in mid-rhyme. It was an evening to forget and one to remember. It was 9:45 and the night was young. At 10:25 I had collected myself sufficiently to return to the world hopeful, and why not, when so many were rhyming the world in their heads, even on their back and in bandages. And while you can't call this feeling love, there being no room for close-up oppression, there was a hope that half was not lost. Parts of the Sunday newspapers still covered the city. The stores are open in a thousand ways to get high, too. Denizens of the night revealed fragments of wild costumes. In the bookstores, an intellectual orgy raged. The smell of pastry and coffee was being attacked by ginger and Mongolian pepper from inside red restaurants. It was possible to consume everything or nothing. Either way, the balance was righted, the consumers as passionate as the ascetics. The Lower East Side of New York moved eternally by a rhythm beating outside ordinary time. No shit. The graces of cheapness. Cheap were the pierogies of the Kiev. Cheap pierogies of the Kiev. 6 boiled with sour cream, $1.95. A whole subclass converted to Ukrainian food, and this without pamphlet or monks. Each pierogi a pamphlet monk doing its preaching in the mouth. If the Ukraine is ever to be free, you must eat all your pierogi. Though there are people who do not like them because they have first seen them fried, which is not always the best way to make somebody's acquaintance. Not a pamphlet monk, certainly. And halfway through my second pierogi, the radio said that John Lennon was shot. John Lennon was shot by an assassin. Minutes later, the radio said he was critically wounded, and later yet, that he was dead. The waiter held his plates, and his face became very sad, and a tear fell on a pierogi, and I was still hopeful. A man named Chapman, meaning Chapman, man, any man. I am no man. A failed double with a gun. A fallen half had been shooting at a symbol and killed Lennon instead. And now his music came from the sidewalks and everyone understood and became much sadder, and their tears fell on solid gold pierogies rolling into image-making machines. The symbolists had killed John Lennon. And I thought, look at it as a vacancy, a power vacuum. A king is dead. It will make everyone think for a few seconds before commerce sets in. And that's no way to think, but it was thinking me. Chapman was now in Bellevue, where I had been, 11:15 p.m., Monday, December 8, an hour earlier, with the other halves, and the hairs on my arms stood over the pierogies when I remembered that it was here, in the Kiev, 10 years ago, that I'd heard of Bobby Kennedy's death, which at the time struck me like the free winds of doom with the apocalyptic illumination of anarchist Jew I owe to myself. Ah, cheap pierogies, in love with yourselves. I was in love, but with no one in particular. Thank you. It's so much more moving how more echo these poems have in dramatic times, you know, but of course this is what we live for. And now I'm going to try this business of reading some new poems, you know, that I hope you'll be indulgent, and because I wrote them and never read them. So here they are. They have some dates. This is July 26, 1999, dedicated to a young poet written at the studio, the Vermont Studio Center. So poetry, they go, I write it. I want to publish it. I am the new flock. I have been taught in school by many renowned poets, all of them great mediocrities. And now I want to put my self-consciousness to use by you so you can recommend me for prizes, grants, fame, and then maybe you can call my mom and say, yes, he made something of himself. He's a poet. And then if you publish a big book of poems, I'll read one or two and give you my begrudging approval in the name of the new flock, even though we are lost and nobody cares if we live or we die, and our websites go unlogged on. Maybe they need more sex, the sex we're not having much of because your fucking generation had it all, plus egos to match, and we hate you. Even those two poems I didn't quite finish from your big new book. Books are dead, don't you know it? July 31, 1999. We live among so many ends, terminals, finals. It's a wonder we don't end every minute. The miracle is that we continue among the detritus of the ends of others to carry on, fueled by curiosity, tattered passion, all sorts of small patched engines. The seas are rough, yes. Our craft leaks, but we will to Rhodes get yet. Well, I didn't say they're all great. They're just dated, which is important. And not that way, I mean, they're literally dated. 10-10-99, for instance. Sleeping with an open eye. Open to what? The world's underwater. Laura needs to give birth to herself now that her long-range emotional plan of bringing father back has succeeded. 3 days of rain and still laden, while my own emotional program, that of overthrowing or becoming the father I made up, is endless. Unless one's program is endless, one must have a backup plan, which is why one walks around the LSU lakes in the early AM and says hello to everyone he meets, though many of them look worse than him. How does one live? Well, how one lives is sort of like this. My son and I said I didn't want to see no Thracian charm bracelets to read the mysterious inscriptions on them, though the Dacians or the ancestors of Romanians, and I might have, by some metempsychotic process, deciphered them. And no, I said, I didn't want to paddle for an hour on the lake in City Park, but I might want to take up a sport sometimes. And we went through all the sports I might take up, and I decided against tennis, handball, racquetball, or running, because they kill guys my age. Just this year, my friend Tom Dent died playing tennis, and maybe I wanted to swim. And my son said that you can play all sports, relaxed. And I said, let's play chess. And when we came to my place, I said, not today, maybe some other time. I am a horrid and cranky old man. But my son said sweetly, some other time. So tomorrow we will translate poems from the Spanish. They are about how hard the world is. And I think that they are also about mean old men. But I hope that they are about joy. To poetry. That nervous energy is called poetry, when you can't stand either still or the world. It's that groove, even half asleep, because the pharmacy of control, the chemical frame around the window of liberty, is stealing away half the energy. Even then, the nervous, half-asleep energy is still poetry. In half bloom, the window open you crawl through to get to the bar and to the girls is really open to poetry. So this year, go there. How I got to America, a burning question. For Chris, who really knows how I got to America, I swam over a barbed wire fence. There was a hair curtain and I scaled it. Then we closed the window. A rabbi hid me in his black skirt. A priest lent me his cassock. I dressed in a cowskin and munched near the border. When the bull came, I ran like hell. They traded me for a couple of spies. I got a passkey to the Western world. I made a fake ceiling in the Bucharest-Vienna Express and curled in there with two of my best friends and a bar of chocolate. The train went to Athens instead, and we died. I wrote a letter to the President of America, and he sent Jimmy Carter to get me with a diplomatic pouch just big enough if I curled up real tight. There was a little war in the Southern Carpathians, and some of us were catapulted into Yugoslavia. I married an extremely rich traveler looking for her roots in my neighborhood. At about 10 p.m. on January 1965, I got inside the transistor radio and surfed the Voice of America to Detroit. I wrapped my hand around the handle of my broom and said the magic words, "Take me to the highs, save me from the lows." But how I really got to America, only Chris knows. And she's not about to tell you. But here is another Chris, actually. This seems to be a Chris series. You know, Christina, two desert monks. And this is really, you have to forgive me. I mean, this is a terribly awkward attempt to be formal. And I think I succeeded. Two desert monks encountered the Christ of happiness, Christina. Yeah, it's a true story about my friend Julian and I sort of having listened to a tremendously boring lecture by a man who wrote a thing called The History of God. Does he live here? I hope not. Anyway, we listened to this, and then we just had to find some place where we could have some wine, and we drove through these sort of half-finished Californian suburbs, you know, and found at long last some place. And this is two desert monks, and you know, encountered the Christ of happiness, Christina. After a century of wandering the desert of Southern California near Pasadena, in Julian's beat-up Toyota, looking for certitudes and faith, we came upon a faux Greek restaurant in a half-built suburb, its freshly painted neon grapes turned hopefully toward the skeletal beginnings of a Sonic and the square image of a coming borders, and there we called for wine. We had barely touched our Redzina when roaring from the empty night, a gold Mercedes braked in the red sand, and out of it spilled a mop-headed waif wrapped in a scarf who called herself Christina. "Gentlemen, gentlemen," she cried, "do you by any chance possess the time?" We possessed no such thing, but offered her our watches and the whole night and day and whatever other time we had, and we had plenty, trust me here. And as she threw herself laughing on a chair and emptied both our glasses with great skill, though I had quit the cigarette I lit, she made my, they were her cigarettes in fact, Winston's with a ripped top she had thrown like a gauntlet on the table between us. "I have everything," Christina said, "a beautiful Mercedes at my command, a virile Serbian under me in bed, as many orgasms as I care without breaking the not-so-fragile vessel of my body, a multitude that loves me to excess, including people you just won't believe. I'm happy without surcease, like a wave rode by a dreamer in a happy dream, and I make everyone happy too. Do I make you?" "Oh, yes," we hasten to agree. "You make us crave all the forbidden things we want to have. We are but monks for one more minute." And yet, she cried, I question this happiness without end. Am I mad? Why don't I have any enemies? Why am I not sad? I love adventure. I am always mad for love, for money, for philosophy. But why no enemies? Why no resistance? Why no iron bed? No crown of thorns? From happiness I suffer. And on top of all, I'm French, and still I'm happy. What is wrong with me? We looked. We smoked her cigarettes. We shrugged. We loved her questions. We loved her without questions, too. We had no idea. We finished the Redzina and we switched to Ouzo. Her great happiness enveloped us in this barely sketched suburban desert land, this faux Greek eatery in Pasadena. How can you answer Christ, the Christ of happiness, Christina? You are the Christ of happiness, Christina, we told her as she roared away. We are no longer lost in the desert. Our souls have grown by a hair and an iota. Yes, Father Julian and I are found. When we got back in his beat-up Toyota, we only found a bit of her dust, and then the sun set over the desert outside of Pasadena, filling us with wonder, longing, and regret. If you see this poem, Divine Christina, make us a sign with your Winston cigarette. And here a poem written in an odd little type, and I don't know, this was written at the beginning, this was 2000 actually, Nickelodeon, this was written actually the day after our totally unbelievable New Year's party, you know, because we were convinced the world would end, you know, we didn't realize it would take another year. Nickelodeon, have 20th century hangover in change jars. Good American change, while paper in denominations of 1 million per square toilet roll size fills the empty dreams of Romanians with numbers, not much else, certainly not sausages on a grill, with new wine in love in, let's say, 1965, when nothing, not even communism, could stop the sap from overcoming the ballyhooed and now forgotten curtain. I had a youth once. I was very good at it. My good cousin Arnold Wesker, a British playwright, you know, he said to me once, you know, I was really good at being young, you know. So this was a sort of disappointment, actually, premature as it turned out, the fact that the millennium itself was uneventful. And it was called, and wrote it, of course, the next day, it was called No Terror, Natives Upset. It goes, the century. Perversely uneventful, not a moneymaker to the news media, no adrenaline pumper for the masses, the very opposite of the grandeur we have come to expect, have the right to expect from this bum maker, pants shaker of a century when great poets died. But fear not, in this millennium we resolve to defend our work against the overwhelming mediocrity of mainstream American poetry. No longer to bear the shame in this otherwise rich culture. We say, enough academic drivel. We're taking back the music. Goodbye. Hello. As it turns out, that was decided for us. So mediocrity is dead. And two more poems. One is a poem I wrote in Jerusalem on my birthday. My father is buried somewhere near Jerusalem. He died fairly young, and I didn't know him very well. But I went to see his grave with my uncle, his brother, who took me there on a very rainy day. We went there by taxi to this hillside cemetery. And we got there, and it was raining terribly hard. And I looked at my father's grave, and it was all written, you know, in Hebrew, which I don't, you know, read. And we looked at it, you know, and the wind was loud, and the rain was loud. And my uncle had this book of prayers. He was going to read the prayer at the gravesite. And these men who make their living in the cemetery reading prayers for the dead were surrounding us and hissing, you know, sort of wanting to do the job for a few shekels, you know, and my uncle kept shooing them away, you know, so they didn't go very far, but they were pissed, so they were like rainy and, you know, wet, and they just had big fur hats that were wet, and they were just these heavy crows, you know, sitting and hissing, you know, so it was a completely odd moment, and then my uncle read from this book, and I didn't know what he was talking about, but I was hoping that we would sort of get back in the taxi, and we'd get back to a cafe or a restaurant, and then we'd talk about my father, because I didn't know what my father's life had been like in Israel, and so we'd speak about it. And so we got to this cafe, you know, finally out of the rain, and my uncle, in typical, you know, Israeli democratic fashion, invites the cab driver to come in and have lunch with us. So I'm about to ask my uncle about, you know, my father, and so we're sitting down, and the cab driver just starts ranting. God damn, the Likud, I'm never going to vote Likud again. You know, so it's just like a wonderful, you know, political rant. So my uncle, you know, I figured he'll tell him to shut up, which would have been appropriate under the circumstances, gets into the argument instead. So then my aunt gets into it. So here they are, you know, Israelis arguing and nothing about my father. So I just have laid back and I thought, well, it's a cipher, give it up. And then I wrote this poem about being there on my birthday and, you know, it really doesn't have anything to do with the story I just told you, but it's called In Jerusalem and My Birthday. And also references my mustache, which I don't have anymore. My mustache is all that remains of Stalin. At the tomb of Jesus, the miracles surround us. Sister Rodica knows every single one of them, Romanian guide we had. The stone of Golgotha is cracked under us. The blood of the crucified washed the skull of Adam. The candles of believers at Easter light from the light. The light hovers before it bursts into flames. In that hovering, the sick are healed. Not one, but many icons cry and ooze myrrh, especially the Mother of God, whose doloroso mementos fill Jerusalem with womanly laments. Endlessly, the stones crack when God and his are hurt. And the wailing wall waits for us, and it heats us up in the rain. We put our heads against it and against all the soggy paper prayers in it. A young rabbi reads a prayer for health. Hand him 20 shekels. Across the wall, on a ridge, a solid mass of black-clad faithful stand under a banner welcoming the Messiah. A donkey laden with gasoline cans descends to the Via Dolorosa. Two horses have broken free and are running into traffic. The Mount of Olives olive trees look scrawny. Scrawny they look in the Garden of Gethsemane. And the young Arabs look at us with burning eyes, and young Israelis with machine guns measure everyone. The spot where the Mother of God fainted, the house of the Last Supper, the church over the spot where Simon Peter heard the rooster crow, the tombs of the patriarchs, the lions of David over the Damascus gate, the son of David Absalom in his grave, the kings and the prophets of Israel in their graves, the golden gate built by the Turks to stop the endless comings of too many messiahs, cities of messiahs on my birthday. And then, of course, this is not the end of the poem, and I can't find the rest of it, this is a break. It's a poem, actually, that ends sort of on the same note, so don't worry if you don't hear the rest of it. You know, it's odd what happens to one's poems. Well, I can never paraphrase that, obviously. From grave to grave in Israel, my father's, the million and a half children's flickering candlelit souls in an infinity of mirrors at Wadi Hashem, at Yad Vashem, Benny Handel's voice reading out some of them. The tomb of Jesus, the wailing wall, wall-to-wall graves, O Jerusalem, the grave of old worlds, new worlds, future worlds, grave waiting for graves. This is where I celebrate my birth, 48 years ago, everything either beginning in 1948 of 1946, the German Transylvanian Hospice St. Charles next to the Walden Templar Cemetery, knots of 46s and 48s. Mary once saw an enormous coffin go in the gate, full of the Templar's treasure, including the Holy Grail. The Romanian church at 46 Shiftei Israel, and all around Israel, a country of children milling about the streets while the elder minority eats cakes and debates the world around coffee tables, but mainly debates the Jews, because to Jews, the most fascinating thing in the world is Jews. Can you believe a whole country full of Jews, asks Benny. It was the letters that got me, I say, the Hebrew letters that always for me were a bit mysterious and forbidden. And we remember the Haifa oranges of our Romanian childhood, mysterious globes of gold wrapped in crinkly tissue, black Jewish letters burning on it like midnight fires in the waning late hours of Stalinism. And in this late age of computers, the Jews await their Messiah, and Christians are ready for the end times and the second coming, and the writers lament the end of the book, and the Dead Sea Scrolls say many circular things. In the Torah-like scroll at the Israeli Museum, an apple core at the center of Jewish insecurity. The bazaar throbs with spices and cassette tapes. The muezzin calls from his tower. The beating of the clapper against the bell is the sound of nails driven into our Savior. Thank you, Sister Rodica. And you know what else? Paradise was closed to men until the ascension of Christ, and then it opens, and now all men and women can go in if they do the right thing, have faith, kiss the stones, buy holy oil, rub it on the afflicted parts, and pray for tolerance as soldiers go by with young voices and big machine guns. Well, that was okay to wait. And I really am going to end with two short poems. One is called, since this 1989 in Romania, everybody's been calling, to ask me if I could get them some babies, because there was this Romanian orphan thing, where Americans all went over there to get babies. So, I don't know. They email, they call. Babies and the two. People call me for babies. I don't have babies. They will stop at nothing, these good grown-up people who will scale the facade of any hotel for the babies inside. They know me. When we have a few drinks, we see each other. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you so much. Now, before we, we go have lunch and things, but, I'd be happy to answer, any questions, particularly if I have no possible answer to them, since I'm from the Ted Berrigan School of, I can't wait to hear what I'm going to say next.
If you have questions, come over to the mics, please, for TV.
Yes.
I wonder if you would tell us why, I noticed in several of your poems that you use the word half, or you talk about images that are incomplete. Would you talk about that for a little bit?
About half?
Yes. Just shortly.
Feeling incomplete is the human condition, really. And I always feel that, I'm very optimistic, which is why I'm saying half, I think my... later poets now from, younger poets, really talk about 12%. I'm still, from a time on half, actually felt like we might have half, it's really a story of diminishing returns. But it's a good question, I'd love to think about it,
For perhaps just half of it.
What's that?
You can just think about half of it.
Well, thank you.
What are your thoughts on the future of poetry, especially of the future of the poets who come to America without English as their native tongue, like Alexander Hemon, for example?
Well, that's two very different questions. The future of poetry, I really couldn't tell. I just wish the poets would start speaking in prose like everyone else. At least for 2 months, right now. But future of poets coming to America, speaking another language, I think it's an ideal place to do that. This country has always evinced a kind of, tremendous, curiosity towards us, strangers coming in and saying funny things, I think. There was a time probably when Americans became more xenophobic, they became a lot more closed and more paranoid, about accents. And this may very well be one of those times, On the other hand, there is no reason why we shouldn't kind of describe what happens to us in a somewhat, free way. That's probably it. You know, I mean, I've come through degrees of whispering where I lived, you know, because when I was growing up, people never talked about anything that mattered except in whispers, you know, and there were times when they didn't even do that. They were, whenever somebody opened their mouth to say anything, they were lying. People lied, you know, I mean, they just lied because that was the way to protect yourself. And it got so bad that they were even lying when they were speaking to themselves. You know, because there are always ears on the wall or somebody was listening, you know, so people just didn't know how to speak anymore, you know. So to be any place where even the idea that you are being allowed to speak freely is important is just incredibly, you know, useful to a young writer, poet.
I was wondering how it feels to read work from when you were much younger.
Well, you know, it's very embarrassing to meet your younger self in public, too, you know. Not just, you know, meet your younger self. But, I mean, one problem is that it's hard to read the earlier poems because of the rhythm, you know, the way I was speaking. You know, I don't remember talking like that, or I'm not sure what kind of, you know, voice I was hearing when I was writing those poems. So I have to kind of remember that, and it's hard, you know. It's difficult. I have no idea what that person was thinking about, you know, I mean, except for the obvious. Yes.
In your own writing, could you speak about the distinctions between your poetry and your prose, and what the line between them, or what the difference?
That's a very good question, and it's one that, you know, has a number of, you know, I mean, it could stretch very easily into a dissertation of some kind, but I'm going to make it very brief, and I think poems are these things that don't go all the way to the end of the page, okay? And prose does. Now, what, I know that's funny, but when it doesn't go all the way to the end of the page, it leaves silence and room for other things to be written in. I mean, my friend Aram Saroyan wrote a wonderful book of one-word poems, and I loved the book. It's called Coffee, and I used it as a notebook for about 2 months because I would just write all over it because it only had one word in it. It was printed, so there was lots of white space there, you know. So, yeah, I think poetry acknowledges the value of silence. And of space, you know. On the other hand, you know, some prose does that too by rushing it. Now, that's real, you know, when I write a story that really works for me is because it's packed with poetry. Now, there is, you know, these commentaries and things and essays that I write which I think have a lot less poetry in them, and they have about 10%. You know, poetry has about 95% like whiskey, you know, these other things are like beer. Because you have to finish your sentences in an essay, in a nonfiction piece, you know, whereas a poet, you are not obliged to finish your sentences. You give your audience the sort of amazing, I don't know what, you know, trust of finishing your sentences, of like being able to work their way into different directions than the ones you intended to, I mean, the ones you might intend, you know. So it's really that kind of, it's a tremendous kind of surrender of your articulation in poems, which, you know, is a big deal, you know, and it makes you no money and it will just cause you endless amounts of suffering. So, you know, you finish your sentences, you make a little cash. You don't, you will be great, but you will be queer. To quote Ted Berrigan again, actually.
How do you feel about the direction of contemporary art and contemporary poetry? And do you think that the...
Can we talk about this later? Yeah, no. Yes. What was the end of your question? I'm sorry.
How do you feel about the direction of contemporary art and contemporary poetry? And do you think that the world events of the present are going to change that direction?
Well, you know, to start to the end of your question, I think, yes, they will, I mean, in some way, you know. But, I mean, the direction, I don't know, because I don't think poetry or art moves in any direction. No, I don't think it goes back forwards, and I don't think it goes backwards, you know, it goes sideways quite often. But, you know, I think one remakes, you know, a writer sort of makes up the world according to, you know, the given information, you know, at any minute. And I'm not sure it's a progressive kind of idea. You know, I don't think it advances forward like communism used to teach us, you know, that we were going to go forward, you know. In my youth, we always went forward, you know. You always said, like, you put your hand to your head and you say, in the name of Stalin, Lenin, Gergiev, Dezhin, whatever's forward. It was always forward, whatever the hell forward was. And I don't think that's, you know, exactly how it works, but it is the, you know, the kind of power of consciousness to take in what your reality is and that of, you know, the emotional reality of the world and make something that is just, it's just there despite all your terror and the fact that it really, you know, it's not approved of by anybody in any kind of way. And so, yes, the events now will change because the world has changed. And, you know, September 11th, the world has definitely changed. We have finished our, you know, Belle Epoque, you know, our wonderful fin de siècle is over, you know. We're entering a very uncertain and different time. And, you know, think about it, in 1914, the Dada poets and writers met in Zurich, you know, to meet in a place outside of war to make a... To write and create things that are purely momentary joy against what they saw as the absurdity of worldwide logic, you know. And so they made things that are really memorable and that are still with us because, you know, they created a psychological attitude of resistance for individuals, you know. I mean, I don't know what the answer is now, but, you know, clearly these are dramatic times, which is great because it restores gravity to the act of being a creator, to being a writer or any kind of creator, because we need gravity, you know, we definitely do. I felt like for, you know, the past, you know, 15, 20 years, everything I've been reading or seeing, there were works done for, you know, the sake of direction, you know, or you know, acceptance in a kind of a drawing, a design of art, you know, or of poetry, you know, and that's not important. It's just not important. There's not enough gravity, you know. Things should, you know, have their mystery and gravity, you know, in a sense that is, you know, existential and completely dedicated, you know. So art really doesn't matter. I mean, art never really did in that way, you know, or poetry for that matter. I mean, you know, there are certain aesthetic gestures that people make or go to school in order to make or describe their, you know, lives in conventional terms of conventional poetry, all of that. None of that matters, you know. All the materials are available now, but the use of them is different, you know. And it's great. It's a complete and utter unknown, you know, but it's grave. It's important. Not to depress anyone. Okay, one more question, and then we'll go to the bar. Yes, I still speak Romanian. Yes, trupul de femeie cel îmbrățișat, nu-l voi duce ție moale și bălan, suferința cerului păcat, nu-i cu ea să turburi apa din Iordan. Do you know that one, Argezi? I know. That's good. All right, thank you very much.
All right, there is an after party at the Big Shoulders Cafe at 8. There will be a book signing, and be sure to pick up your limited edition broadside. Thank you for coming.